from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Dave Iverson. When lifelong Democrat Susan Kennedy was chief of staff to Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger, she routinely put in 12-hour days, then turned around and drove 90 miles back to her Marin County home, working all the while, not placing phone calls or placating old Democratic allies. Instead, she focused on making sense of another locale where fires burn hot, Dante's Inferno. It turns out that for all her smarts and hard work, Kennedy was a college dropout who needed to decipher Dante before she could get her college degree. In the hour ahead, Susan Kennedy joins us as part of our first-person interview series, where we meet the Bay Area's leaders, innovators, and unique individuals. Susan Kennedy, next on Forum, after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Dave Iverson, in today for Michael Krasny. Here's how the Los Angeles Times once described this morning's guest on Forum. Rarely venturing into public, she instills fear in legions of state workers, lobbyists, and lawmakers. That sounds like some sort of super action hero stalking the hallways of the Capitol. This person is also one the Times called the most enduring force in state government in the last decade. The force is Susan Kennedy, a lifelong Democratic activist who once ran the state Democratic Party, worked for Dianne Feinstein, was cabinet secretary under Gray Davis, and then startled the political establishment when she became Arnold Schwarzenegger's chief of staff. Today, Susan Kennedy consults on clean energy, serves on the new California Health Exchange Board, and is a senior policy advisor for Alston and Byrd. She joins us this morning as part of our first-person interview series, where we profile the leaders, innovators, unique individuals, and super action figures who helped define the Bay Area. Susan Kennedy, good morning.
Good morning. Very good to be here.
Happy to have you join us. Tell me first, when Arnold Schwarzenegger came calling, what made you answer?
Well, I had been following very closely what was going on in Sacramento, and when I worked for Governor Davis and I left to go on the Public Utilities Commission during when the recall happened, I hated Arnold Schwarzenegger like everyone else did. I hated the recall. I tried to help Gray against the recall, and I spent the next year after the first year that Schwarzenegger was in office watching what he was trying to do and realizing he was bumping into the same problems that I was. So I spent a while watching and kind of converting to this idea that something big has to change in Sacramento, and I came to respect what he was trying to do. But by the time by the time that call came in, I thought he had squandered so many of his opportunities to rally people that when the call came in, I banged my head on the table. So I was like, oh, my God, why couldn't you call me like a year and a half ago? But
so what made you say yes? I mean, rather than to keep banging your head on the table.
Because I was at a point in my career where I was either going to walk away from a 25-year career in politics where I had spent my entire adult life believing that in politics and in government you can affect change, and I had washed my hands of that and said I don't think that's possible anymore. I believe he brought something so unique to the political body, and that he's a good man, and that I wanted to take the risk, and so I did it.
What did you see that was unique? What is that quality that you think still is necessary to bring about change?
I think there were a couple of things in descending order of importance. The thing that made him so unique was he honestly believes that there is nothing that cannot be achieved if you put your mind to it. And he has proven that to himself in his former iterations of his own life. And he applied that to politics. That opens up a whole new world. When you enter politics and say, what is possible, not what can I do with the limited means I have, but what, let's try for something that's never been done before. And you believe that if you're not inhibited by the constraints of the traditional political stuff, you can get a lot done. And so he brought that kind of belief that anything was possible to government. And that is really the thing that's missing with most of our elected officials today, that have to look at the constraints of the political system. Second, I think he absolutely eschews partisan labels. He was a Republican, proud Republican, but he was not part of the labeling of a Republican. He didn't care about it. He was quintessentially a Californian and a Californian first. And you have to be able to let go of that identity that other people impose on you in order to do things that serve the people and not the party label.
I'm interested in this because it seems that that belief that everything is possible and this desire to approach things in a new way that we're not just, divided up by reds and blue, that's a quality that you could argue is also present in President Obama. And yet he has bumped and stumbled in many ways. I think it's fair to say that Arnold Schwarzenegger wasn't able to execute much of what he might have wanted. So
I want to disagree with you on that last point, but
okay.
Go ahead.
Well, I'm just interested in what you also have to have, besides a belief that you can do anything, that anything is possible, which I think is so apt about what we most want in leadership. I'm interested in what else you have to have in order to make those things happen.
You have to have a skill set, and that skill set either comes from experience. Well, it only comes from experience. So I think what Schwarzenegger made some mistakes when he first got into office that was simply a product of not being familiar with the way Sacramento works and being familiar with the way politicians think. And almost everybody in Sacramento is a politician. And so it takes a while to learn how to leverage the tools you have. And then the last thing is timing. I mean, you really need circumstances to allow for big things to happen, and it's almost like catching a wave. The waves come constantly, but if your timing is off and you're not there when the big wave is coming, I don't care how good you are or how good of a surfer you are, you're not going to catch that wave. And so, timing, skill, and then the ability and belief to do something that's never been done before.
You picked up with him that headbanging moment that you describe when he had gone from the big high of the recall to some big bumps with the failure of his special election referenda. You picked up then at that point and led him back to riding the wave.
Right. Now, go ahead.
No, I'm just interested in what was that you were able to do? Because it seems to me at least that his years in office were this sort of rise and fall. So I'm interested in what you did to pick him back up on the way.
Well, first of all, you have to remember that when he went down in flames in the end of 2005, that was after he had some amazing successes. And we don't – it's really hard to see the whole picture when you're only counting, the top of the apex on the nadir. But the fact was that he had used the tools of being a celebrity governor so successfully in his first year in office that he tried to replicate them again by threatening to go to the ballot. And he made some major changes his first year in office. And then he came back and he tried to do it again on budget reform, on redistricting, on a few other measures threatening to go to the ballot. And he was within a week of pulling off this stunning victory, and he ran out of time to get the new ballot measures, the compromise measures drafted and passed by the legislature in time to pull the ill-fated ones off the ballot. But you ask Speaker Fabian Nunez or anybody who was in the negotiating with him, and he was within a week of pulling off a major, major victory. And when that time passed and he was forced to go to the ballot and defend those initiatives, it was too late, and they went down in flames. So we had to pick him back up again, and it wasn't hard because he just had to focus. He immediately picked himself back up and focused on the future, on how he was going to change. And we just had to articulate that to the public and figure out how to enact some of the changes he wanted to enact. And if you recall, in January of 2006, he announced the largest rebuilding campaign, infrastructure campaign for California since Pat Brown was governor. And it was about moving California forward. It was something Sacramento had never seen before, a $260 billion infrastructure plan. It was a 10-year plan, and we got almost all of it done. It took us 5 years, but we got pretty much every element of it done, including the water package that Governor Brown is now trying to actually get built, is the water piece of the infrastructure plan that we launched in 2006. So it was a very simple message. of building California for the future, moving the state forward, and he and his own fortunes were reversed instantly the moment he started talking to the people again about moving forward.
And then they were, over time, reversed again. Would you say that that was circumstantial, or did he make real mistakes?
So
that
reversed?
When he left, his ability to accomplish what he wanted to accomplish, his ability to be perceived by the public as this great figure, he left office with approval ratings essentially equivalent to Gray Davis. So what happened? Tell me what his weaknesses were, or whether or not that was all circumstantial.
Let me first just separate the two issues, because they are not the same. Sometimes when you want to accomplish change, you have to assume that change is hard. Change is going to cause people to attack you, and so you have to be ready for your polling numbers to drop through the floor. And he had made that decision. So I would argue that Schwarzenegger was responsible for more reforms since any governor since Hiram Johnson was in office. The redistricting measure, the change in the open primary, those are the two of the biggest, most fundamental reforms to the body politic of California in many, many decades, and we were responsible for that. We ended up reforming through every budget negotiation, almost every program in Sacramento. You wouldn't even know about it, because all you know is we were fighting in Sacramento, and the public said, a pox on both your houses, and they punished everybody because we were fighting. But we actually won almost every single battle on every single reform package that we put in the budget.
You sound like you're still ready to do battle.
Well, you can't spend 20 years in politics and see and actually, get how you accomplish something, and then, because your polling numbers are down, say, well, I didn't accomplish anything. And just, you can't submit to that. Or why would anybody get involved in politics? Now, the fact was, there was a point in time when I remember talking to the governor, and he said, if we go forward, we tried to get the parent trigger and the school reform. We were negotiating school reforms in the budget. And he said, if I go forward with this, I'm going to be attacked. CTA is going to spend millions of dollars going after me. I have to be willing to walk away from any public approbation for any of these changes, because this is going to be really tough. And they did. They went after him. He dropped 20 points in the polls. We never fully recovered from that. And Schwarzenegger made a decision. I have to choose. I'm either going to go for change, or I'm going to try and keep my poll numbers up. And he went for change.
What about, though, on the budget side, Susan Kennedy, where when he left office, the state was arguably in worse shape than when he entered in terms of being able to have a balanced budget picture? Was he tough enough in that regard? Was he honest enough?
I disagree with your premise. I mean, I've been involved now with, 12 years of budget negotiations through Gray Davis administration as an outside person, and then back in the Schwarzenegger administration. And I think he made one mistake that he would look back on and say it probably wasn't the smartest idea to put in the permanent reduction on the vehicle license fee,
right,
when he did,
right,
and not go for permanent changes have the fight about budget spending in that very first year. But the public needed a little bit more healing at the time. He didn't have the right timing is everything. He would not have had the public behind him had he had that fight then. But I would argue that we ripped out of the autopilot spending, whether it was the prison guards contracts, that was $1 billion in spending that we ripped out. The autopilot spending in almost every program, COLAs. You know, if you think that COLAs are a good
cost
thing,
of living,
then you're going to it built into the budget. Not voted on, built into the budget, then you're going to disagree that he accomplished anything. But the fact was, we ripped out probably $5 or $6 billion in autopilot spending as a process of budget negotiations, and that was simply and Brown has kept most of them, and they were some of the most important battles that we could have had, and we won them.
Do you think that we see these things and view leaders based on sort of our assumptions about their labels? And by that I mean, I know you believe in, from something I read recently in the great Nixon Goes to China rule, that people can accomplish something because they're seen as a conservative, they can go to China. Jerry Brown, because he's seen as a Democrat, can push back at the legislature and accomplish certain things, whether that's being tougher on the unions or cutting back on social spending. A Democrat can do that where a Republican can't. Did Arnold Schwarzenegger take advantage of being viewed in a different way? Could he have done more on the Nixon goes to China rule?
No.
By tackling, for example, Proposition 13, didn't he have a wonderful opportunity
if he believed in changing Proposition 13, then he would have done it. But just because he doesn't believe in changing Proposition 13 doesn't mean he was—
Would you have liked to have seen him do that?
No. I think it would have been a complete waste of time to try and go after that. There was such a the larger issue with our tax system is that it is so steeply progressive and so heavily reliant on personal income tax that every time there is a contraction in the economy, we lose 50% of our capital gains revenue. 25% of the state budget revenue can disappear with a relatively modest contraction in the economy. It is unsustainable. And what Schwarzenegger tried to do with the willing participation by the Democratic leaders was put a tax commission in place that came up with the best ideas they could come up with, a nonpartisan commission by consensus, the Parsky Commission, over the course of a year. And it never even went to a vote in the legislature because it's hard. And is that's what needs to change in our tax system. You know, Prop 13 is a red herring, in my view, in terms of solving our problems.
Is California governable? We seem to have a kind of built-in way of not getting things done. Now, that's different to some degree now, of course, with the Democrats and the supermajority. But do we make it too hard to accomplish things here?
California is hard to govern. It's not impossible. I think. Frankly, we proved it. We got the Democrats to do things that the Democrats said they would never do. And they voted to either curtail, change, update, lessen, you know, whatever social programs that they were really afraid of the consequences of doing that. And we got them to do it. Schwarzenegger proved that you can get Republicans to vote for tax increases. He did it not once, not twice, not three times, almost five times. He got Republicans to give up their seats in order to vote for tax increases that were in the budget. So don't tell me it can't be done. But he did it the old-fashioned way. He had to structure a deal between both sides, and we called it the burning building strategy. You have a building where everyone's in. You lock all the doors and windows except one at the other end, and you light a fire. And you have to be willing to look them in the eye and say, we're all going to stay in this building and burn unless you go out that door. And that's how we got the Republicans to vote for tax increases, and that's how we got the Democrats to vote for changes to entitlement programs.
There's a story that's told about you. I don't know if it was the water bond or not, but that you went to the Democrats and said, if you don't go along with what the governor wants, governor's going to veto your piece of legislation. So you got to come with me on this. And you went to the Republicans and said, if you don't come with me on this, the governor's going to sign the Democrats' legislation. Is that a true story?
Yes.
Are you willing to play that way?
Absolutely. And both were true. You know, but we had for most of the big changes, we had to play the Democrats and the Republicans off each other. And you have to do that. The secret to success in doing that is you have to mean it. And they knew we meant it. And the fact was, whoever made the better deal to the governor was going to get their way. And anybody, it was almost like a baseball arbitration. If you're going to be so extreme, then you're guaranteed that we're going to go with the more reasonable offer.
Bob Haldeman, the chief of staff to President Nixon, once famously said, "Everybody needs a son of a bitch, and I'm Nixon's." To some extent, is that the role you play?
I think that's true. I think I played that for Gray Davis as well. I was the son of a bitch for both.
And what do you like about that role?
You know, I didn't choose it. It chose me. But I think it comes from the fact that somebody has to be willing to look you in the eye and tell you the truth. And you know, in politics, it's very hard to have people mad at you and not like you for whatever policy, whatever thing you have to do. But the fact was that I had to be the one to look them in the eye and say, you're not going to get what you want here.
Where does that come from in you?
Honestly, it comes in part from this may shock you, but I am a card-carrying member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And one of the first things you learn when you become sober, and I've been sober 18 years, 19, it'll be 19 this year. One of the first things you have to learn is rigorous honesty. And the concept of rigorous honesty, for most people who are addicts or alcoholics, you learn to lie. Little white lies become part of your everyday existence. And so the process of learning rigorous honesty is being able to – it's almost like it was that movie with Jim Carrey about, you know, he couldn't – he had to say the truth. I mean, you had to learn how to say things that made me uncomfortable, made other people uncomfortable, and that became part of my MO. And I found it was a lot easier and a lot better to just say what it is and say it, get it over with, and say it honestly. And the consequence, it was a lot easier to deal with. Plus, I also worked for Dianne Feinstein, and she was a known terrorist when it came to staff who like pretended they did something or knew something they didn't know. And so I learned very quickly working for Dianne that if you know you go to her and you tell her up front, this is what I did, this is the mistake I made, this is what I didn't get done, and that takes a lot to do, but it's you survive it a lot better.
Does the lessons you learned as someone who's, and do you call yourself still a recovering alcoholic, is that a permanent part of sort of how you approach things and the kind of toughness and discipline and kind of rigorous honesty with which you lead the rest of your life?
Yeah. I mean, you don't ever – you're always a recovering alcoholic. You're never a recovered alcoholic. Right. It's if I ever forget that, I'm in danger of becoming someone else, becoming someone I was. And the world is a very different place when you can medicate your way out of uncomfortable situations. And so it does take a certain toughness and a certain ability to handle realities that are uncomfortable. And some, you got to learn to let them glide off you. Sometimes it's not just a tough skin, but you learn to live with difficulties.
And is that quality something that you look for in leaders? You said Dianne Feinstein was someone who didn't suffer fools gladly. Is that a quality that you want in a leader? In other words, would Susan Kennedy be a good elected official? Is that a quality that's key?
I think it is. I think it makes a huge difference in your leadership ability. But it can also be – I mean, we sometimes don't make great politicians. I may make a great leader. I don't know if I could ever get elected to office.
Would you want to?
No.
Why?
You have to give up too much. You have to give up too much of yourself because you have to – you're everything about your life it goes under a microscope. And I don't really feel like spending half my time explaining to other people why I did certain things or why I believe certain things or why I changed my mind about something. I think I can spend my time much more wisely and effectively working behind the scenes with people who are willing to give up that part of themselves to be a public servant.
Is there anybody you'd want to go work for now? In politics.
Oh, if Hillary Clinton becomes president, I'd stop what I'm doing and run to Washington.
You want her to run?
I want her to be president. I have mixed feelings about her running only because she has attained a stature, an international stature, that only being Secretary of State can gain you. And I don't want to see that tarnished by the rough and tumble of a campaign where she will be subjected to the same knife fight that she was subjected to before. And so there's a part of me, I very much want to see her president. I would feel like we're giving up something by having her run.
If she called you and said, should I run, you'd say?
I'll wait for the call.
Susan Kennedy. We'll talk more after this short break. If you have a question you'd like to pose to Susan Kennedy about leadership, about politics, about how things can work better in California, you can join us now at 866-733-6786. 866-733-6786. Email us at forum@kqed.org. I'm Dave Iverson. This is Forum on KQED. Welcome back to Forum. I'm Dave Iverson. Our guest this hour is Susan Kennedy. She joins us as part of our first-person interview series where we get to know the people who are making a difference in the Bay Area and in the state as leaders, innovators, and unique individuals. Susan Kennedy was, of course, the chief of staff to Arnold Schwarzenegger. Before that, ran the State Democratic Party, worked for Dianne Feinstein, cabinet secretary to Gray Davis, currently working on a variety of public policy issues, particularly in the clean technology area. We were talking before the break about people you admire, and Hillary in particular. She's so much in the news this week, so I just want to spend one more beat on that. And I sensed in what you were saying that you really want her to be president, but you really fear what she will go through to get there. Is that inevitable in our process, that all those knives will come out, all those stories from the Clinton marriage will come out, all that stuff will be gone through yet again?
Fear's the wrong word. Mm. It's about whether I would be willing to give up the stature that she has gained as an international leader and an icon for women, and have her tarnished again, not because of the scandals or anything like that, but just because as a woman candidate, we have not yet broken through in terms of a strong woman leader making it through that knife fight and into elective office. And so the attributes that you would normally find admiring in a man that makes him a good leader, she will be attacked for it as a woman. And we haven't, and I just don't know if I'm willing to give up what she has attained for all of us as an example, as a groundbreaking woman, international leader, in order to see her president, when I'd really like her to retain that stature.
So interesting. I mean, because it suggests that there's such a price to pay. I mean, to
huge.
Get where you'd like to go.
Huge price. Absolutely. This is a culture change. This isn't winning a political office. This is a culture change, just like President Obama was a culture change for the United States in being the first African American president. There's a long way to go before we have the same culture change for women in elective office.
I know you're probably going to say the same thing when I ask you this question, that you'll wait for the call. But what would you advise Barack Obama? Are you happy with what he's done? What does he need? What does he lack? If you were his chief of staff, what needs to happen? It already feels like we're far into his second term, and we're less than a year into his second term. So what does he need?
Well, I think the answer to that depends. I won't get that call, so I'm willing to answer that question. It depends on the perspective. I mean, am I happy with him as a Democrat? Am I happy with him as a Californian? Am I happy with him, as an American? Those are all very different perspectives. So, start with as an American and as somebody who's in politics and wants to see government leaders succeed. Because it's good for all of us. I think that he's had some very big missed opportunities. And I think that comes from the skill. It's the same lesson that Arnold Schwarzenegger learned when he went into office. His skill set was not – he had to learn by miles on the odometer, how to deal with the politics of the situation. Obama had to learn how to deal with the politics, and so I think he had some missed opportunities.
Is that another way of getting at – Arnold Schwarzenegger famously said, he's going to blow up the boxes, that you can't blow them up if you don't know how they're built?
Yes and no. I mean, I would argue that Schwarzenegger said he's going to come in and blow up the boxes. He figured out when he got there that Sacramento was the box. And so he did blow up the boxes. The open primary and the redistricting were two earth-shaking changes to California's political system that's going to really change the way we govern in Sacramento over time. That is the most important box.
I guess what I'm trying to get at with the parallel here is, as you suggested, President Obama didn't know all of the ins and outs. Is that what Hillary Clinton would have trumped? No, that you have to know the machinery.
I think you start with an advantage. I mean, I think President Obama came in with one deficit, and that was the experience of dealing with Washington and that level of change. But he brought another attribute, that that kind of outsider idealism that a jaded politician necessarily wouldn't have. So I wouldn't say it's a net negative, but I think there were some missed opportunities because of the skill level. I think Hillary would have come in with a different skill level that would be very attractive to me as somebody, a practitioner, somebody who wants to see things get done. I would have loved to have seen her years of experience applied to the problems that we were facing when we first got into office. I think we would have had somewhat of a different outcome.
Susan Kennedy, our guest. You can join us at 866-733-6786. Let's hear from Chris first. Chris, go ahead.
Yes, hi. I just had a comment that I was planning on turning off the radio when this segment came on. I was on to doing something else, and to be honest, I was prepared to pretty much hate anything that was going to be said about Arnold Schwarzenegger, just being raised liberal and just thinking, well, I'm not going to have anything interesting, you know, sent my way during this one that I really need to hear. And then listening to your guest, listening to her fire, her conviction, and her intelligence and clarity throughout this whole segment has, first of all, really fired me up, and I've loved the segment, first of all. Second of all, the burden of proof now for myself lies on me to be able to look up the different things that she's been talking about and, you know, decide for myself whether I agree with everything. But another burden on myself is to really think about my own prejudices and, I guess, for lack of a better phrase, like kind of the cult of personality of, like, well, I'm a liberal, therefore I must hate everything that, or project, maybe project is a better phrase. I must project certain things onto situations, whereas, you know, like your guest was describing, certain situations, and as I listen to them from this, from the inside, it's, I can hear how people are intelligently trying to solve a problem, whereas from the outside, a lot of times I think we all project things onto people, and yeah, no matter what they're doing, it seems like, well, they're the enemy.
Chris, thank you. Precisely what we were talking about, actually, during the station break about this very point. Go ahead, Susan Kennedy.
Well, I had the same. I was telling Dave before, during the break, that when I decided to go work for Schwarzenegger, it was in a meeting with a bunch of Democratic friends, and they were all attacking. This is in 2005, and they were attacking Schwarzenegger. And I just blew up, and I said, wait a minute. You're attacking him for doing the very exact same things that Gray Davis did. And yet, because he had a D next to his name, you supported him, you voted for him, you worked for him, and he has an R next to his name, and this guy's evil. And so it was a very epiphany moment for me in terms of realizing that I am assuming that he's bad just because he has an R next to his name. And that was the moment I decided that I had to eliminate my reference to the party label in order to be able to understand issues and what people are about.
It's a big challenge. I mean, we all fret and moan and groan about polarization in this country, and we all tend to sort of point the finger. But it's the old business of looking in the mirror, and to some extent, the polarization starts in us, right? I mean, that isn't going to change unless we begin to be able to look at people without what letter is between the parentheses after their name.
Yeah, that's the God's truth.
To Colin in San Francisco. Colin, go ahead.
Good morning, Ms. Kennedy. I'd like to get your opinion. You stated before that it wasn't worth the time to try to change Proposition 13. Do you agree, however, with Warren Buffett's observation that it isn't quite fair that he pays more in property taxes on his residence in Nebraska than he does in his mansion in Malibu? I mean, it seems to be a very glaring inequality.
Yeah, but I can name 10 other huge inequalities in our tax system. It's not perfect. I think it's out. It may have outgrown its usefulness, but it's not a simple fix. But there's our tax system is so convoluted and so butchered by loopholes that I think we fixate on Prop 13 as if that's the biggest loophole, and by fixing that you would solve a bunch of social problems. You won't. It won't even raise that much money.
Do you make determinations then based on pure pragmatism and kind of whether the pain is going to be worth the gain?
From a foundation of values, you know, and this is where the polarization stops us from looking at other people and who are of a different party and assuming that we share the same values. The fact is, as most Americans, we do share the same values. I served on, but the way you approach solving a problem, if it differs, we tend to say, "Well, your approach differs, so you're wrong. I'm right, and you're evil, and I'm good." And that's where we break down in terms of our ability to solve, to approach problems in a pragmatic way and not get stuck. I served on the Public Utilities Commission. We were five Democrats all appointed by the same governor Public Utilities Commission. We disagreed on the approach for how best to protect consumers, and I was attacked as being nothing but a shill for big business. Just because we disagreed on whether how you protect consumers in a competitive market, so I found out firsthand that we first have to be willing to have a debate about that and recognize the values that we share, and then we can debate tactics on how to solve a problem.
When do you make decisions about sort of when you're going to sort of put everything on the line and when you sort of look at things more pragmatically? As an example, you're a lesbian, married, and during your time serving both Gray Davis and Arnold Schwarzenegger, you counseled them not to support gay marriage. I'm interested in how you came to that determination and how you applied sort of who you were and your values to how you sorted through that as a public policy question.
It was not a question of supporting gay marriage. That
right.
was never a question. It was a question of whether or not to sign legislation that was in violation of the initiative that had passed in California, and whether or not, as the chief executive, whether it was Gray or it was Arnold Schwarzenegger, could you sign a piece of legislation that so blatantly violated the will of the people with the Knight Initiative? And the answer I got from the Democrats who authored the bill said, well, it's not in violation of the Knight Initiative. You can't, because you cannot overturn a state statute, an initiative that's voted on by the people with a statute by the legislature. You have to go back to there's a process question here. And my belief was that if you thumb your nose at the voters so blatantly that, yeah, we know you voted on this, but we're going to ignore it, that the retribution on that is going to be, as an openly gay woman, I'm going to pay for this for the rest of my adult life, most likely.
Do you worry about that now in terms of the recent court decisions, that this will come back at how the referenda process works?
I think there's always you always have to be conscious of that. But again, it's a timing issue about, when you ask the voters, what you ask the voters, and how respectfully or, whether you challenge what the voters have done. Because the voters, we vote for bad initiatives, and they deserve to get overturned by the courts. Fact was, Arnold Schwarzenegger made the decision not to challenge not to represent the proponents of Proposition 8 in the court. And I held my breath at some point thinking, is this the right decision? Because if we all looked at the court's decision, their vote count, and we said, wow, well, what if we had standing? We might have gotten the five votes we needed. So I questioned, was that a mistake? But he made the decision based upon his moral belief that I am not obligated, and I don't want to defend this. I don't believe it should be defended, and he didn't. So that was a pretty fateful decision. Was that a pragmatic decision? No, that was a moral decision he made.
And in the end, it's what, of course, the Supreme Court made its decision based on, was that question of standing. But it sounds like to me that your focus in that particular regard that you had. Now, I don't know how quite to say this. It's not like you set aside your personal views. It was more like something else trumps here.
Well,
right?
Two things. Yes, I was an advisor to a governor. So my opinion only mattered in my private counsel to him, but either both of those governors, my private counsel. As a staff person, an advisor to him on his job as governor, that took precedent. That was my job. So my job wasn't to say I disagree with what you're going to do on a moral basis. I had to make those decisions every day I was in office. But there was he had a legal obligation as the governor. What is the role of the chief executive? Can you sign this bill and be consistent with the law and be consistent with your belief and your respect for the will of the voters? Is this the right thing to do? You have a choice. Sign, veto, let it become law without your signature. Those are the three options.
It sounds like what matters most to you is sort of just the facts, ma'am. I mean, that let's set aside what initial is after your name, whether it's D or R. Let's set aside other things that might be important to us personally, we have to focus on what the law is, what the facts are, and drill down on that.
You have to start with that, but it's a balancing act. I mean, if you either live by the rule of law and you never deviate from that, which I think ends up with very bad policy, or you live by the ends justify the means, and I can disregard the law and I can do whatever I want because the ends justify the means. You can't live in either world. You have to blend the two. You have to say, how do I change the law? Gavin Newsom made a decision to ignore the law and sign marriage certificates in San Francisco. That led to one of the cases that went to the Supreme Court. Was that an immoral act? No. Was it a violation of the? Was it a conscious violation of the law? Yes, it was. And so, you know, we got lucky. That was a good case, and we ended up, you know, in the right place at the right time. I think it was Bill Clinton. He made the decision to sign the Defense of Marriage Act. If he had not signed that bill as a compromise to something worse, we probably would have faced. That was a let's get out of Dodge move on his part. We would not have had probably one of the best cases to go before the Supreme Court. So, you know, was he a friend or foe when he signed that bill?
A listener asks, what are your primary guiding principles when it comes to your political dealings?
My first is honesty. Integrity. So, and that's about truth. From that point, you have to then decide what is it I want to spend my energy trying to achieve, and what is the price I'm willing to pay to achieve it? Because politics is the art of compromise, and you have to be willing to say, this is what I want to achieve. What am I willing to give up that I don't necessarily need to give up or want to give up in order to achieve that goal? But everything starts from the integrity of agreeing that you're going to be honest, because even you have to decide what problem you're trying to solve. If you're trying to if you agree on what problem you're trying to solve, then it becomes a negotiation process for how you solve it.
Some of our listeners want to know how you'd solve certain problems before the state. So let's get the Kennedy prescription on some of these. State workers' pensions.
How would I solve them? I think you have to revisit the structure of the benefits in order to ease into place workers paying more towards their benefits over time and their health care over time. I think that the risk and the reward have to be more balanced. And I actually think the approach that Jerry Brown took in the beginning was a pretty solid one.
It's another Nixon goes to China moment, isn't it? I mean, to deal with that.
Absolutely. We got pension reform before we left office in 2010, and people were shocked that we were able to force any pension reform, and we got some. But I think where Jerry Brown was willing to go in the beginning was a big deal. I don't think he got what he was looking for, but that was the right approach.
But he has opportunities in that particular realm in terms of dealing with whether it's unions,
He's the only – I don't think a Republican could possibly do it. I think the fact that we got any reform at all was a miracle.
BART strike.
How would I solve it? Oh, I have no idea. I'm not – I just want BART to be there when I go to get on the train. But I think it comes down to the fundamental question of what we have an antiquated system when it comes to pension and health care benefits. And health care is a key issue. And so you have to go in and look at what is the role of the employer today in guaranteeing those health benefits and paying for those health benefits.
Ken writes, does Susan Kennedy think that the NSA domestic spying on California citizens is a violation of the California Constitution? We're wanting you to be an expert on the California Constitution, which I know may not be within your purview.
Not.
Any views on that topic?
First of all, I am not a lawyer, so my views will not be upheld by any court of law. But I think that – how do I say this? I think – privacy, the whole concept of privacy has completely changed in today's world. And I think the kind of information that was being looked at and gathered is to be expected. I think it's legitimate. I think that it is the use of the information that we should focus on. The technology today makes it almost impossible to not gather that information, because if we're not gathering it, I guarantee you somebody else is, and they're probably bad guys. But it's a question of what you do with the information. And just like the fruit of the poison tree cannot be used, you know, an illegal wiretap cannot be used in a court of law in the United States. Information that was gathered surreptitiously or against the law should not be able to be used against an American in the United States. But I actually think that it's a pointless crusade to try and prevent the gathering of the information. I think it hurts us in the long run.
Steve in Oakland has a question for you. Steve, go ahead.
Hi, thanks. Great discussion, guest. You'd mentioned that you thought President Obama made some big mistakes at the outset of his presidency. Were they regarding the way he sold health care, his appointment of Larry Summers and Tim Geithner at the outset, which resulted in some problems with his economic policy that we may yet pay for down the line, regarding the failure to adequately regulate Wall Street, or other issues? That's kind of a leading question. I'd welcome your disagreeing with it, or just your general sense of what specifically in terms of policies he did wrong, or the way he approached the press.
I think what you also said was he missed opportunities, which may be different than making mistakes.
Yeah, that's a better way of putting it. Thank you.
Yeah, because I want to say I'm not being critical, because I don't believe I'm really in a good position to judge. But as an observer and a practitioner of politics, I would say that he missed a couple of opportunities that cost him some ability to get some things done. If I could have orchestrated his first term, I probably would not have taken on health care when he did. I would have focused in a slightly different way on the economic recovery. Not slightly. I would have focused in a different way on the economic recovery. He was handed a blueprint for the recovery from the administration of President Bush. So he started with a set of cards that he probably – I don't know how much flexibility he had to change those. But I would have focused on bringing the Republicans to the table. I would have made an overt effort to bring the country together in the Recovery Act. And what I saw happen was the Democrats ended up using the recovery as a playground for a lot of policies that were not immediately needed in order to – we were in a crisis. And I think that we cost a lot of political capital to put in place policies that had no impact on the crisis at the time.
Is that something that is always a challenge for elected leaders to understand? When George W. Bush was reelected, he said the day after his election, I've got political capital now and I'm going to spend it.
Yeah.
Well, it's arguable whether or not he successfully spent it or not in his second term. But is that part of what people need to be always more tuned to? You only have so much and you got to be careful about how you spend it.
Yeah. I am second guessing the decisions he made, and I feel bad doing it because I know what it feels like to be a newly elected official. You make the decisions you make based upon what you think you can get done, and you know there's no wrong answer there, right? Because history will always, you know, always judge you harshly one way or another. But the fact is he came in and he did not. I would have used him differently. I can't emphasize the fact that I don't feel comfortable saying he did something right or wrong. I just would have done it differently because I think he ended up with a cost to his political capital that he didn't have to have.
And in terms of his legacy, it may well turn on how well the Obamacare turns out. You have a role to play in that on the healthcare exchange. How do you think that's going to play out? What are you trying to ensure happens?
This is a big topic. Healthcare reform. We make a mistake with health. I think healthcare reform from the Obamacare is going to succeed. I have much doubt of that. I think the doomsayers that say it's going to bring the economy down are just that. They're doomsayers. The problem with healthcare reform is that the reason we've chased this rabbit for the last 100 years, almost every president, dating back to Teddy Roosevelt, has pushed for some form of health care reform, is based on cost. Cost, cost, cost. Every time we actually attack the problem of cost, we end up going for universal coverage. and we it's like we have ADD when it comes to dealing with health care. And so every single time the federal government has attacked health care costs, we end up thinking that if we just get more people into coverage, we'll be able to bring down costs, and we focus on the coverage piece of it, and costs actually go up, not down. So there's 25% roughly of the population that is still not covered by health insurance when at the outset of health care reform. And President Obama is like the dog that caught the car in terms of this, the seminal healthcare reform measure of the century, of our generation anyway. And the fact is that we are going to spend billions and billions of dollars in all these years, and we're probably going to get maybe 12.5% if we're very lucky. Success is getting another 12.5% of the population covered. Costs are still going to go up. They're not going to go down. So we're going to end up having the same conversation about the crisis in healthcare. We're already having it, and we're going to continue to have it. So based upon the cost metric, I don't think most people are not going to assume it has succeeded. Based upon the coverage metric, we might actually succeed.
It's a question from a listener, and it'll have to serve as our last question. I've followed Ms. Kennedy's career over the past 15 years, but I'm still not exactly sure what she stands for. So in the end, what does Susan Kennedy stand for?
Truth and the American way. How do you answer that question as a human being? What do I stand for? I believe in humans. I believe in the potential. I believe in the human potential. I believe in honesty. I believe in candor as a political tool. I believe in that as a society we have the power to help people, and that we should use our power to do that. And I believe in individual responsibility and individual. I believe in independence, and that we ought to respect an individual's ability to do for themselves. I believe in teaching a man to fish, not giving him a fish. That's a much more powerful. But some people you have to give a fish to. Okay, but you know, it's if we ever lose sight of the fact that that if people aren't learning to fish and able to fish on their own, then we have no society.
And you have to be tough and diligent and a force to get there.
I think when you're honest, you are a force.
Susan Kennedy, our guest as part of our First Person series on Forum. Thank you very much. Pleasure to have you on our program.
Great to be here, Dave.
Forum is produced by Judy Campbell, Irene Noguchi, and Tina Lorberg. Our senior editor is Dan Zoll. Raul Ramirez is our executive producer. Amanda Stupai, our engagement producer. Danny Bringer, our engineer. I'm Dave Iverson, in for Michael Krasny. This is Forum on KQED.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.